Here you are at the News Hour on the Heritage Radio Network. A lot of exciting stuff has happened this week. We just planted a garden on the top of our two shipping containers, thanks to a grant from Alice Waters in Berkeley, California. So it actually feels cooler in these two shipping containers, thanks to about 3 tons of soil sitting on the roof. People don't know the shipping containers are an excellent housing solution. Anyway, it's a very, very, very exciting hour of news today. We have guests, and I'm very excited, actually. I'm looking out the window of our shipping container into Roberta's restaurant, and I see our two guests, Damien Sansonetti, the chef from Barbalou, and Mario Carbone, the chef from Aero Nuovo and the JetBlue terminal at JFK, also a chef of the Bastianich Batali Empire. Very exciting. But before we get to all that, we're going to cover some news. The Kiplinger Agriculture Letter says that many state ag budgets are in for big cuts. As a result of additional belt tightening by states, 4 or 5 states face bigger deficits than expected. Among those are New York. Their ag department faces 25% deficits, and Arizona as well. Very serious. But we love the Kiplinger Ag Letter because it distills a bunch of news into a few sentences, which makes my job easier. Then we have an article in the Progressive Farmer. And it's an article by Marcia Taylor, and she gives this amazing statistic, and I'm quoting, "The number of elderly farmers over the age of 75 outnumber the age under 25 by more than 5 to 1. At anyone 65 and over, and the elderly outnumbers youngsters by 15 to 1. And those two stats basically mean our farmers are getting older. Not enough people are getting into the business. Even so, young farmers seem to be vanishing. Between 2002 and 2007, we lost more than 20% of the farmers under the age of 45, but added nearly the same percentage to the over 65-year-old ranks. So our farmers getting older. Part of the goal of Heritage Radio Network is to get more young farmers on board." Next story we decided to cover. This news comes from the New York Farm Bureau. And the New York Farm Bureau writes that winemakers and grape growers are almost unanimously wanting grocery stores to be allowed to carry wine. Right now, grocery stores and bodegas are not allowed legally to sell wine. That monopoly exists, you know, with wine stores and beer stores and places like that. And listen, if the grape growers want it and the wine growers want it, then Heritage Radio Network wants it. It's a very interesting, this is what Governor Patterson says. This is, our New York State governor who took over for Eliot Spitzer. He writes, "New York's wine industry is growing exponentially." Wait a second. That's not what he wrote. What did he write? Actually, I cannot find his quote, but he is basically saying that wine is growing in New York, and why would we not allow them to... this is what he writes. "New York's wineries have gained in quality, reputation, and quantity. We need to open up what is essentially a state-sponsored monopoly to allow over 16,000 grocery store licenses to also sell wine." That's absolutely true. And as an example, when Washington State adopted the sale of wine in grocery stores and interstate direct shipment, relaxing their state laws, a few years later, that state surpassed New York in the rankings as the second largest wine grape growing state behind California. So selling wine to grocery stores is important. And, you know, we just started our network, so we don't know how to define evil people, but people who own wine stores, give it up. You're in the minority. Once the farmers come out against you, the world comes out against you, even though it might be over time, but give it up. You had a monopoly for a long time. Now let grape growers and wine growers expand and grow. Do not limit them because of your own greed. That's disgusting. It really is. For you to make money instead of, now, again, Walmarts and all that, we don't believe in them. And in fact, in Arkansas, Walmarts are now allowed to sell wine, even though, and beer, even though, you know, for a long time, that state had had rules that you could not sell, for instance, firearms in the same place that you sell alcohol. They're making the exceptions for Sam's Club. But, you know, I just think people need to buy from small local businesses. But you cannot limit farmers' potential because of the greed of a minority. So open it up. Let supermarkets carry wine. That's the end of it. If anyone wants to call in, they're welcome to. But if they support the other idea, you know, they're going to have a short span on the Heritage Radio Network because they don't have much of a point. Now, talking about a few other things, Verizon Grant puts CD history of New York agriculture lesson plans on the web. This is the second Verizon story we've done since we've started our network, but it's an absolutely important company to keep mentioning because I think that a lesson plan for seventh graders that talk about, you know, learning more about family, the foods that are sold in New York State and the region is a very important thing. So more power to Verizon. That's the second time their company has been brought up, you know, for good things. Then in another article, we're coming towards the end here. The battle over sliced apples. Kristen Gillibrand, who is our new Democratic New York State Senator, taking over for Hillary Clinton, wrote a letter to Tom Vilsack, basically trying to get more schools to buy more local produce. And basically, they're trying to get cafeteria kitchens they want to change them from reheating stations, which is exactly what they are right now. They're reheating processed foods. And they're trying to build the infrastructure to actually teach the school chefs how to cook. Actually cook, not reheat, but cook. And I remember Thelma, who ran the Browning School's cafeteria for a long time. I think she was a cook. Chicken a la King and Sloppy Joe's and stuff. Anyway, better a Sloppy Joe that's cooked than a Sloppy Joe that is reheated. Hopefully they'll outlaw Chicken a la King altogether. But it is very important that these employees be empowered to cook. I mean, that's why they were brought on. Without further ado, those are the news stories of the Q Report. We're going to cover two more topics, basically, including one with our foreign correspondent, Renato Sardo, who is the founder of the International Office of the Slow Food Movement. He's going to come on and talk to us about a couple of articles that ran in the San Francisco Chronicle this week. Each week, we look to all the major food sections around the United States to see which ones are worthy of being covered. And there's usually not more than one or two per issue, you know, if that, that are worthy of being covered. But when we get back, we're going to talk about a new FDA nominee and sponsored science and a real horrible article by Julie Gunlock, who basically needs to find real work. You don't know what love is. You think that it's a toy. Hey, how was that? A pretty little game played by a girl and boy. You won't talk about it. You don't even care. And you just take for granted I'll always be there. You play, you stay away. Now we're going to cover basically three San Francisco Chronicle or San Francisco or California related articles. And we're going to have, you know, I'm a big fan of this guy who's going to be on in a few minutes. His name is Renato Sardo. He started the International Office of Slow Food, and now he lives on the West Coast, so he's a perfect person to bring on. The first two articles I'm going to bring up are Marion Nessel is actually involved with both of them. The San Francisco Chronicle has been very open to giving Marion Nessel space in their publication, and she basically was quoted twice, or basically had two semi sections, I guess, in the Chronicle. First one is about President Obama nominating a new FDA head and Food and Drug Administrator, and her name is Dr. Margaret Hamburg, H-A-M-B-U-R-G, and Marion thinks she's a great choice to basically fix the USDA, and Marion mentions a couple of things that need to happen in the Food and Drug Administration. One is they need to basically be empowered. Right now, the FDA doesn't even have power to make food recalls. Food recalls are completely voluntary. Second thing about the FDA, they currently inspect just 1 to 2% of imported food shipments. I mean, with all, what are we waiting for? I mean, with all of food terrorism and all, you know, September 11th, what are we waiting for? 1 to 2%? Are you kidding me? We should get Dr. Hamburg in and give her real power. And Marion recommends, you know, concentrating the resources of the FDA on the highest risks and enforce the existing rules, as if, you know, enforcing existing rules is a major concept. And just to speak a little bit to the absurdity of the FDA, the FDA used to be part of the USDA. But then they separated. And with that separation, here are a couple of ridiculous things Marion points out. Whereas the FDA oversees the safety of cheese pizza, the USDA oversees the safety of pepperoni pizza. And whereas the FDA oversees closed-faced meat sandwiches, the USDA regulates open-faced meat sandwiches. Totally absurd, you know, a little embarrassing. But more power to Obama, and hopefully Congress will nominate and make official Dr. Margaret Hamburg's nomination. If it means anything, she is endorsed by the Heritage Radio Network. Now, we are also talking about a second article, which came also about Marion Nessel, talking about how basically this horrible op-ed by James McWilliams that basically associated free-range pigs with trichinosis and the pistachio scare and salmonella. I mean, total embarrassment, not only to America, but I'm sure to his own family for coming out against the few farmers that are able to do well. Basically, his op-ed was sponsored by, his study was sponsored by the Pork Board. And it brings up a lot of interesting issues, like what rights do animals have, and, you know, are free-range pigs really dangerous? And so one of my favorite people in the food world and a kind of mentor to me, Renato Sardo, is calling in from California. Hey, Renato.
Ciao, Patrick. Nice to hear you.
Yes, nice to hear you. So where are you calling in from exactly?
Generally, I would be from Oakland, but today I'm from L.A., like Fairyland. I mean, in a hotel in Beverly Hills, we're surrounded by gorgeous women everywhere. The power of yogurt, amazing. Yes. Everyone is eating yogurt. Everyone is beautiful. The weather is fine. And I am here with you talking about pork.
Well, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. So, I mean, now you basically lived most of your life in northern Italy, right? In the Piemonte.
Yeah. I lived until I was 36 in Bra, which is a small town near Turin, northwest region of Italy, near France. And I moved to California 3.5 years ago, and I still involved in the food world, I was, as you said before, I was working with Slow Food, with you actually, Slow Food, when we opened Slow Food USA. I worked in Slow Food International till 3 years ago, and now I'm still involved in the food community. I've helped a little bit last year with Slow Food Nation, and I'm still in the food community in California.
Now, were you? Did you hear anything about this California animal rights ballot that's trying to ban factory farms from confining?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's an interesting proposition that has been endorsed and approved. Nobody really knows exactly which will be the consequences, but it was a powerful sign of California public of the willingness of the California public to move forward on a more sustainable production system.
And is it going to decrease the amount of food available? I mean, what is the effects?
Many people are saying so. Many people are saying that much of the production is moved in will move to Arizona or to bordering country states. Mm. I have to say, nobody. I haven't heard any feedback about after this vote that was made last year. Nobody has really followed up. There hasn't been, as far as I know, any consequences, probably the implementation of this rule will be diluted in time. You know, there will be a scale along several years, so at the moment, no major changes about that.
Now, for instance, where you live in Italy, where you live for most of your life, like, what do Italians or Europeans view as their moral obligation to animals?
Well, you know, that depends, really. I mean, I think as a general, like, the people will leave, I mean, it's very similar to U.S. Like, we have in Italy, anyway, like the portion of the state intervention in the economy is larger in Europe than in U.S., mm-hmm. and we see that as a natural fact and as a desirable fact by many. I mean, I have to say, for example, in most of the Italian towns there is a slaughterhouse which is directly run by the town.
Interesting.
And I have to say that. I don't know exactly why, but it seems that probably because the consolidation of in the farm industry happened earlier in U.S. and the lobbies are more powerful here, it seems that in Europe the consumers' rights are a little bit more protected than in U.S. A little bit more. I mean, there has been an erosion lately, but it for example, nobody in Europe can gives drugs to hogs if we stay with the hog.
Right.
Like, you know, the prevention use of antibiotics to hogs in Europe is forbidden. You can give drugs only once you can test that the animal is sick. While in Europe, in U.S., of course, it seems
you
that 70% of the total drugs have been used to animals. To healthy animals.
Yes, exactly. Not even to sick ones.
That's an example. Then there is the growth hormone example. You know, in Europe you cannot give that to animals, while here you can. So, I mean, and it's been demonstrated that this generates cancer. So there are definitely differences. And I hope that this nomination, that the new government will, that the pendulum will shift a little bit, at least also in our sector in the food business, because so far really all the rules and has been basically tailor-made for big corporations.
Exactly. And now, if the food is going to have to cost more because of these things that you and I agree with, who do you think should bear a brunt of that expense? Should it be the consumer, the government, the processor, the farmer?
I think a little bit everyone, but mostly the consumers, to say the truth. I mean, we have to... Yeah. That's one of the things that, you know, Carlo Petrillo of Food has always said, but it's we pay too little for food. It's, you know, the poorest people, beside those who have not a job, are those who are work for farms today in U.S. and in Europe. And it is probably to say that consumers will have to pay more for food, and we have to get over the fact that food has to be, you know, super cheap. We have to pay a little bit more for maybe buy a little bit less of it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that for some food won't be affordable anymore means that we will have also to work on redistribution policies. In reality, food has to be more expensive.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, this has been a great talk. I want to ask you one last question, Renato.
Sure.
Same with this elitism issue. All these people now, I just read this sad, pathetic article by Julie Gunlock, anti-Alice Waters. Food needs to be cheap. I mean, how do you answer this truthful comment?
It's a very populist thing, you know, to say, you know, food has to be for everyone and cheap, and it's very easy to get along with that, you know, to be transported by that and saying, we have to recognize that the $1 hamburger is a disaster for us. It costs more than a dollar because simply in health costs for us, and it costs way more for society. So it doesn't exist anything as a $1 hamburger. We have to pay the proper price for food. And Alice is one of the figures who's teaching that. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, many are angry with that. In some cases, there is, of course, some dishonesty, but there are certain who are honestly thinking that food has to be, like, cheap food has to be a right, really. And it's an achievement of our society, and this has to be defended at every cost. And Alice is a somewhat menacing figure.
Isn't that sad?
In that sense, yeah. It's very easy to believe that, but I don't want to sound too rhetoric, but we have to learn to consume less. Mm-hmm. In the world, in the future, in the Western countries, in U.S., in Europe, and we have to start paying more for food.
Well, so, Renato, I mean, you're very wise. It's absolutely true. You say it very eloquently, considering English is your second language. I absolutely agree. Very wise.
Thank you. Yeah, I will learn with English better in the future.
Okay, good. And one day we'll
do it in Italian. I don't know.
Va bene. Listen, thank you so much, Renato. I hope you are a frequent guest and contributor to the Heritage Radio Network. It's always good to talk to you.
Okay. Have a good week.
Thanks, Renato.
Ciao, ciao.
climbing, sleep by the side of the road.
We have just finished the first part of the Hardcore News Hour, and now we have two guests. We have three guests. One is That Music, who will not be coming back. And then we have Damien and Mario. And Damien Sansonetti, am I pronouncing it correctly?
That's correct.
Is here, and he is the chef from Bar Baloo, right in front of Lincoln Center. And then we have Mario Carbone. Or Carbone.
However you want to say it.
And he is a chef at Aero Nuovo. He's been chefs many places.
Nuova.
Aero Nuova. Very good. And he's a chef at JFK Airport, Terminal 5, the JetBlue terminals, kind of helping change institutionalized dining in this country. So welcome, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Mario. Tell us a little bit about where you've cooked and you know, how you got to where you are today.
Long story short, or you want me to stretch this out a little bit?
Yeah, stretch it out. We have a half hour. Well, so have your wine.
As a good young cook of 15 years old in Queens, your options are pretty limited. You start by making fried calamari. And red sauce, colored sauces, red, white, pink from time to time, at good Italian food in Queens. And then from there, you move up the ranks, hopefully. You go from oyster shucker and clam shucker to fry guy, and so on and so forth, until finally you decide that maybe scholastics isn't for you, and you choose a vocation. And for me, that was Culinary Institute of America after high school.
Which one did you go to, Napa or?
No. I stayed local.
Okay.
I wasn't allowed to go to Napa. My mother would have cried and cried and cried.
Good Italian mother.
Yeah. An hour and a half was me moving to Europe. At 18, I went to CIA, I was planning on doing all 4 years, which encompassed both the associates and the bachelor's. I did my internship for Mario Batali when Babbo had just opened.
Okay.
And Mario decided that I didn't need the final 2 years of my education because a garmage position was available the day after I graduated my associates at Lupa.
So he must have really liked you because he was asking you to compromise.
Well, yeah, it was a combination of he really liked me and he really needed to fill that position. And I was cheap labor. So I passed on further education for slicing prosciutto at Lupa in 1999. And worked with him for quite some time through four restaurants, off and on. He was a crucial part in sending me to Italy, where I worked for a year for a mom and pop restaurant in Tuscany.
Okay, what was the name of that place?
La Dogana.
La Dogana. That's a famous place, right?
No, it's a. I mean,
it's an osteria, right?
It's an osteria. It's, you know, it's famous only in its own town,
right?
But you know, it's the place where you take, you know, where you go for a special occasion if you live in that, in those two or three encompassing neighborhoods. I spent a year there, and that was, you know, definitely life changing to learn the culture and the language and just the appreciation for simplicity. And then I returned, and I went from simplicity to Wiley Dufresne and Daniel Boulud. Just because I was revolting against Italian food at that point. I was like, oh, I need to see something else. And then eventually made my way back to Mario. And most recently, when JetBlue, more specifically OTG Management, approached Mark Ladner, who is and was the executive chef of Del Posto, where I was working at the time, to be the consultant at this project, which is Terminal 5 for JetBlue, to be the consultant for the Italian project. And I was working side by side with him, and Mark decided that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot left for me to really accomplish at Del Posto. Mark wasn't going to quit anytime soon.
Right.
And so I decided to tackle this kind of new world, take over the leadership role. It was a great experience. Isn't was a great experience to work there, kind of run my first kitchen and be in a corporation for the first time, because even though Mario's company is so big, it's run very much as individual restaurants. You know, mm-hmm. there's no general tomato sauce recipe that all the chefs follow. Right, we all run everything our own way. So to see a corporation was something new for me, and it's been a good experience.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, they sent you to the airport, but then you stayed at the airport. They didn't send you off. I mean, very interesting place, JFK. Fascinating. I look forward to talking more about that as we continue our interview. So we're also with another Italian, surprisingly enough, Damien, who I think you are the one Italian in the heading up a restaurant within a French empire, correct?
Yeah, pretty much.
So tell us a little bit about your history and how you got to be the head chef in front of Lincoln Center.
Well, I pretty much originally didn't even plan on becoming a chef or anything. My father is a chef, but early on when I was little, it was always, you know, like to cook. Grandparents are both Italian, so, you know, making the pasta and roasting the peppers and canning stuff in the summer. I mean, that's like, you know, the thing I grew up with. But I went to regular college, University of Pittsburgh, you know, chemistry classes. But I was sitting in class and thinking, when am I going to go home and cook, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But and I was working at a local diner at the time through high school and college, you know, dishwasher, then short order cook, and just, I don't know, at one point just said, oh, you know what, let's take a shot at the culinary school thing. Went to local culinary school in Pittsburgh, where I grew up at, Pennsylvania Culinary. And I don't know, I just kind of fell into a good externship with, I didn't know who they were at the time, the Myriad Restaurant Group. Myriad.
Oh, Myriad.
With Drew Neaport and Michael Bonides. And I had no idea who they were at the time. I did an externship on Nantucket Island. I was like, oh, this is cool, you know. You know, I'm 19 years old, hanging out on an island, you know, it's great, you know, cool hours, good money, you know, it's the beach. So then they asked me to come to New York City to open up a new restaurant with a bunch of people they kind of handpicked around that worked with them for a little bit, and that was the W Hotel.
Okay, and where is that?
It was the first W Hotel, and it was on Lexington and 49th Street, Heartbeat.
Was Michel Nashan involved at the time?
Yeah, that was I knew Michel before when he was the, I guess you say, corporate chef for Myriad when he was at Tribeca and everything. And we got along really great, and he brought a bunch of guys that he knew from around Myriad and kind of picked them out of all the restaurants. And it was a great restaurant. I mean, it was a kind of a cool little thing at the time he had going. I mean, pretty much everything we had in the restaurant was organic, and when we could get it was local. And he kind of got me into the whole, you know, local food and farmers markets, and more so than I'd already been into it. And kind of like a little bit of a mentor to me.
He had a kind of heart healthy, very healthy cuisine, right?
It was kind of like we'd use a lot of juices from fruits and vegetables and made our sauces out of that. We didn't use any butter in the restaurant. We only used certain fats too that were beneficial to you, like we would use a goat's milk and something because the enzymes are easier for you to digest and break down. So that's kind of his whole idea behind all of it. And everything was completely organic. And at times, I mean, this is back in 1998. Everything was still like ridiculously expensive too. So it was just, it was definitely a big thing at the time. I mean, I don't think some people were ready for it. But it definitely got my interest into a lot of different things. So over the years I was working, and then I ended up meeting Danielle when I went to dinner at Danielle's one night, and we just kind of hit it off, talked a little bit. And then at one point, just from eating in a restaurant, I talked to him like, I like the way the restaurant feels. I like the way the service is. Mm-hmm. I like how he is. And the time just kind of was right at some point, and I ended up working for him at DB Bistro. And then after that, ended up being a sous chef at Danielle's. And then the time came to open up Bar Balloon, and he asked me to be the executive chef there, and I said, cool.
Well, that's a great great question to be asked. And let me ask, when you guys were growing up and realizing that while everyone was studying, you were like, oh, I want to cook, or, you know, learning with your... Was that, like, weird? I mean, was it you know, while some kids were like, oh, I want to be a professional basketball player, and you guys were like, I love cooking. Is that, like, a... Was that unusual? Did you feel different? Was that unusual, or was it totally natural growing up in your environments to be like, has being a cook always been rewarded even 15 years ago or 20 years ago when you guys were growing up?
I'll take that. For me, it wasn't that much different. You know, growing up in a pretty predominantly Italian neighborhood, high school definitely Italian. You know, there's always food. It's not this weird thing. It's not this takeout. It's not this obscure culture. It's someone's making it, and it's a very understanding. You know, that mom or dad or grandma, somebody's cooking it, and it's a legitimate thing. It's not it's not where does my food come from? You know. You have a great understanding, and you know, if any of your quote unquote boys are going to make fun of you for cooking, you know, it's just like, well, the girls love it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you're same way. It was just a total natural.
It was natural. I mean, both sides of my family are huge, absurdly huge too. I mean, my dad's side of the family is like ridiculously large. You know, you meet the cousins and it's like, I didn't even know I had these cousins, but it was almost like cooking though too was always competitive in a way, because you go over for, especially when all the families get together and somebody's house, and always rotates around who makes the sauce and how they make the sauce. And everybody is like, oh wow. And then behind their back, it's like, well, you know, they could have used this better tomato, or where did they get their basil from, or something. I mean, you know, it's always like a little competitive kind of spirit, you know,
100%
behind that. So it was always this kind of natural. So, I mean, it was just something that was so enjoyable growing up young, and it was kind of like those memories, and my grandparents are still around, so it was it's still great to kind of share those times with them. And I mean, it was just fun.
Before we cut to a break right now, who was your mentor within the family? Was it mother, grandmother, or was it someone different for both of you guys?
It was definitely my grandfather. My grandfather on my mother's side. He was that figure that was transcendent. It was more than just dinner. And it was also because as a little kid, you only went there when he was really on. It was for holidays, it was for special occasions. And he made sure, you know, for me, it was that visual of you can really make a meal something of an event all of its own. It's this special thing. It's this transcendent thing of this initial chef figure for me, of someone who's really a master at its craft. And it was great.
Very interesting. For you, Damien?
I would say originally it was my father, because he is an executive chef, and he worked for Marriott for almost 30 years as like a corporate chef. But in essence, it was both of my grandmothers, because one's from Central Italy, one's from Southern Italy. So kind of working with and like growing up with both of them, it was just kind of the passion that they involved into it. And it was always like they both always had something cooking early in the morning, throughout the day, late at night, always had some kind of cookie they were baking every day. It's always drying pasta. And both of my grandfathers couldn't cook to save their lives. It was just, they were just like the breadwinners. They were, and both my grandparents both raised large families. So they were the ones always at home, but they always had something going on.
That's so funny. That oven was on a low flame.
It's always something going.
So this is a real honor for Heritage Radio Network. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about differences with Italian and French food, urban farming, institutions, sourcing. So we'll be right back with Damien and Mario.
And James and Tom, stick around and tell us all the tale. When I fell in love with a Gun Street girl, and I was dancing in the Birmingham jail. Dancing in $100 off a slaughterhouse Joe. Bought a brand new Michigan 20 gauge. You got all liquored up on that roadhouse corn. Blew the hole in the hood of a yellow Corvette. A hole in the hood of a yellow Corvette. He bought a second hand over from a Cuban Chinese and dyed his hair bathroom of a Texaco, with a pawn shop radio, 4:15. Left Walt Keegan at the slamming of the door. Left Walt Keegan at the slamming of the door. Said John, John, he's long gone, gone to Indiana, he never come home. I said John. Soaking day old bread and kerosene.
the shadow fix a taller with an old trombone. He never get up in the morning on a Saturday. Sitting by the eerie with a bullwhip dog. Telling everyone it's all he went that away, boys. Telling everyone it's all he went that away. Now the rain like gravel on an old tin roof. Burning to northern, pulling out of the world. Now a head full of bourbon and a dream in the straw.
So here we are back with Damian Cincinnati and Mario Carbone talking about food. And this is part of a news hour because, you know, it's time the food became more part of the news. So now, Mario, you once said something very interesting, and I'd like you to repeat it to me about what is Italian food to you. You know, I was like, what food do you do and what's the difference between the cuisines? How did you answer that?
I think what sparked that conversation between you and I was an article that I had read. It was last year. It was written by Ian Fisher, New York Times. And it was an article about Gambero Rosso, which is the almighty and powerful god of rating and ranking in Italy.
Italian wines.
Wines, food, restaurants, oh, really? Everything. Huh. They really find themselves to be the most important. Just ask them. and they came out with a ranking of the best carbonara in Rome, the 10 restaurants that serve the best carbonara, one of the most traditional dishes in Rome. They ranked the 10 best carbonaras in Rome, and the winner, by Gambero Rosso, the most traditional of all traditional people, was a chef from Tunisia.
Hmm.
His name's Chef Hassin, and he's from Tunisia, born and raised, and moved to Italy when he was 17,
mm-hmm.
worked through the ranks, no different than Damien or myself, worked right. through the ranks, worked in the proper kitchens, learning the real way, using their real ingredients and traditional techniques, and turns out to make the very best carbonara by Gambero Rosso in all of Italy.
Hmm.
So does it mean that it's less Italian because the chef's from Tunisia, or can he not make the very best of the most traditional food because mm-hmm. he's been trained that way?
Right.
And that... You know, you can stretch that argument into a lot of different facets.
And the point is, he can make Italian yeah. food, because what is Italian food? I mean, your point is that it doesn't matter what your genetics are, where your blood is. It matters that what?
Even furthermore, it doesn't matter where the product comes from. It doesn't matter, you know, who's making it, where the food comes from, where you are at that time, what environment you're serving it in. None of that really matters, in my opinion. I've gotten to the point with myself with that argument that I firmly believe that I can make for all intents and purposes for myself as a professional at this point, I can make something inherently more Italian here in Brooklyn where we are right now, using the food out of the garden where we are right here,
mm-hmm.
more Italian than shipping guanciale from Rome to mm-hmm. here, because that's a more traditional ingredient. It's right. you know, it's a false way of looking at it. And if you were to take a person from Italy, or a chef, or a mom from Italy, and transport her here the way the immigrants were transported here in the early 1900s, they were forced to use what was around them and make what they remember
mm-hmm.
was food from home, and that created what is Italian American food.
Mm-hmm.
And that for them was traditional, even though they didn't have prosciutto, they yeah. didn't have
San Marzano.
They didn't have San Marzanos, you know, and that's where little things like the lemon peel in the espresso in Little Italy comes from, is because mm-hmm. the coffee wasn't bitter enough for them when they got here, so they needed mm-hmm. the twist of the lemon,
mm-hmm.
which you'll never find in Italy.
But it doesn't make it any less legitimate. It's just how Italians deal with their food. Do you agree that Italian food is more ingredient-based and using the freshest ingredients possible than it is?
Oh, totally. I mean, because like my grandparents, like, you know, Mario was saying, like, when they came over, they didn't have everything that they were accustomed to having. So, you know, my grandmother had to use, you know, canned tuna fish at times because she didn't have the real good, you know, tuna and olive oil that they had. You can get, like, now you can get it. It's easy to get it now, but, you know, she kind of adapted everything that she needed to. And I mean, it's just like taking the purest ingredients that you can find as close to the farm or field that you can find them and making something beautiful with them.
Now, this whole urban farming thing, which you actually mentioned in your thing, in your piece that you just said, Mario, I mean, is urban farming, I've always thought, like people say, you know, can organic or slow cooking feed the world? What about urban farming? What about taking advantage of all these lots, the empty lots? I mean, you running restaurants, would you guys be open to, you know, three kids with a big backyard growing stuff and saying, hey, these are tomatoes from, you know, almost in the same way that in Berkeley, everyone was growing Meyer lemons, you know, in their backyards because it grew there? I mean, is there a future for young gardeners to have an outlet, for instance, at your restaurants?
Oh, absolutely. There's a total legitimacy today and a demand for, particularly, you know, if the chef wants to do it and the chef wants to say, I'm only going to use local products and preach that, it's one thing. It's another thing for the customer to understand the importance of the chef saying that. Because if there's no audience, then what's the point of Damien and I seeking these ingredients out? It's just for us. You know, there's a give and take relationship to any restaurant. There's the food that's being produced, and then there's the audience that's going to consume it. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take the audience understanding. And I think that they definitely do in places like New York and California. And you know, it needs to stretch out across the center part of the country and, mm-hmm. and you know, the corners north and south. The understanding of the importance of that, because I think across the board, the community of chefs understands it. They get it
right.
Everywhere, all over the country. It's local products, local ingredients, and there's a definite legitimacy for chefs to do that. Now it's on the audience. They need to appreciate it. They need to
what, to be prepared to spend more for it. Yeah, is that what it is?
Just like the conversation that you had earlier.
Right.
You know, the customer needs to be willing to spend a little bit more to sustain this and the understanding and appreciation for eating something that just came from their area.
Now, Damien, isn't it a pain in the butt to source from 20 different people when you can just source everything with one phone call to a big company, for instance? I mean, how many chefs are willing to have the patience that I know for a fact both of you have to, you know, understand the situation and work within it? Like, isn't it more difficult?
No, I think it definitely adds a little bit more. I look at it as fun because, you know, kind of in a way you're like a food stockbroker, because you got to call people up and, you know, talk to them and say, okay, what's the price of sorrel today over here and what do you have? Because some companies will carry something better here, or they have something better this, or they're better, you know, like we get pretty much all of our pork from Heritage, you know what I mean? So it's it's little things like that we like to take care of and do. But I think, like in New York City, I think we have a lot of untapped resources mm-hmm. for doing a lot more of the urban farming or, you know, rooftop gardens. Mm-hmm. A guy I used to work with, he was a general manager of a restaurant I was working at, and he kept complaining that, you know, he had all these tomatoes. He was growing, he had a full garden on top of his condo that he set up, a rooftop garden, and he had, his tomatoes were so prolific, he didn't know what to do with them anymore. And he had sorrel and rosemary and thyme and tomatoes and all kind of stuff. And he was like, dude, just bring them into the restaurant and we'll just mm-hmm. start cooking with them throughout the summer. So he kind of like self-sustained us with a certain section of produce for a whole summer.
Wow. Very, very interesting. Well, here, that deserves the sound effect. I don't have the cue card for which sound effect is what, but let's listen to 7. That's not what we wanted. Hold on. Yes. That's what we think about. Applause. That's what we think about. So what else do we have? All right. No more sound effects. We finally got the sound effect going. But very, very, very interesting. I mean, I find this absolutely fascinating. So when we come back for our last segment, maybe we could talk about like institutional dining, which I actually put Barbaloo certainly in that because of sheer volume of people. And then, of course, an airport is a very interesting institution. And Heritage certainly believes that changing institutional dining is a big part of the future. And I can vouch personally, no chefs do more than you two for actually putting their money and their effort and their energy and their time where they say they do by supporting good things. So we'll take a minute break and come back with Mario and Damien.
that you might learn to stay away from sin. I took a life not mine to take, imprisoned for this haunting dread mistake. My heart was harder than my soul. They sentenced me to life without parole, where no one cares, we're all the same, and I must wear this number for my name. Now life to me is black and white. I'll wear these stripes until the day I die. But this ball and chain around my leg won't drag me down, won't drag me down.
The Heritage Radio Network with a garden on our roof and shipping containers around us, and we're with two of New York City's great young new generation of chefs, Damien and Mario. And both of you guys basically run institutions. I mean, how many people come through Bar Ballou on a week, or how do you judge it? Number of covers? I mean, what?
I don't know. Last night we did over 500 people, which was kind of ridiculous, but
500 people.
Yeah, for dinner.
Wow. And that's right in front of Lincoln Center. For those of you who are not from New York, very, very central part of New York. And airport. I mean, how many people are coming through a JetBlue terminal on any given day?
I mean, it's difficult because we don't have a reservation system. So it's kind of like, you know, you ask the last guy in how many cabs are outside to figure out how, you know, how busy you are. You know, so there's anywhere from 15 to 20,000 people go through the terminal. And, you know, we can do 500 or 600 people all day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, Damien does that in one service, but I, you know, mine stretches out all day. I'll do about 500 or 600 on a busy day.
Wow. And what is the difference? I mean, as a young chef out there who's like, you know, I want to change this, or I want to work at a place that really has a lot of high volume. What's the difference between cooking at a low volume place, you know, that does, you know, 20 people perfectly or 50 people perfectly in a night versus what you guys do now?
Well, I think for one thing, for us, is with the fact that we do a certain amount of volume, and the fact that we're kind of in a in an area that's with Lincoln Center, and you get the opera crowd and the ballet, and, you know, you're going to have a different mix of people coming in as well. It also allows us the opportunity to buy a lot of sexy produce and, you know, proteins as well. So we can kind of introduce people to new things that, you know, maybe some other restaurants don't just have the option to get in. We do, because we can use them and we utilize them every single last thing that we get in for it too. So whenever somebody gets something and we get it in, they're like, oh, wow, that's cool. And, you know, then that kind of gets their interest going. And then hopefully then they'll go out and try and procure it themselves. And that way it'll start supporting more of the farmers and everything else, like, just right down the road.
But then from a strictly technical standpoint, how do you cook for 500 people versus 20? Do you just make bigger, more of each thing? Or, I mean, how do you, what's the difference between running a little place and a big place?
I mean, I've run both kinds. And I kind of like a busy place for sure. But we still don't, I mean, we don't skimp on the quality at all. I mean, there's definitely going to be, you know, maybe a steak comes back that's a little more, you know, medium to medium rare. You know, there's going to be a little miscues here that you may, you know, with a few less covers, you may not have that as much. But I take it that I have a really well-trained staff, front and back of the house. They're very dedicated. They're very passionate about what they do, and they definitely put in the time and energy to. to do it.
But you have more people, basically. More people, more runners, more... It's just the same grammar, just times 10?
Somewhat, but I mean, you'd honestly be surprised with the amount of people that I have. Some people come into the kitchen and are like, oh, wow, you have a lot of people here. But sometimes I look at other restaurants that are, I guess you could say, more French brigade. Like, if you compare us, I guess, Danielle's. I mean, they have three times the amount of staff that we do. So at times we kind of have to multitask a little more and do certain other things too. I mean, obviously the restaurants are very different animals in themselves, you know? So, but my guys are, like I said, they're very dedicated and they just kind of do what needs to get done.
How is your, and then I'm going to ask you a couple of questions too. I mean, how is Bar Balou different? Like if someone's like, how does that kitchen run? Well, how is it different? How is it similar? What's its thing? I mean, is it, individual teams, each with their own head, or is it more of a top-down? I mean, how for someone who's never been into a kitchen before, how do you explain to them what goes on a Bar Balou kitchen?
Well, I kind of run it. I mean, I've worked with Danielle for almost 6 years now, but I mean, you can definitely feel his presence there and his philosophies and everything behind it. But I also run the kitchen the way I like to work, and we have fun, you know. Because I think when you're cooking food, you don't want to be miserable. You don't want somebody yelling at you all day long either. Mm-hmm. You want to have fun, especially it's long hours. Mm-hmm. You know, it's long hours. And I mean, if you're happy, you're doing good, you know, you're going to put out good, beautiful food too. And you're going to put that love into the food. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're all kind of almost all on the same level. I'll do anything that needs to get done. And I expect, you know, all my cooks do the same thing. And everybody kind of cross trains and learns mm-hmm. this and that. And it's not uncommon to see any of the sous chefs go over and, you know, even take dishes out of the dish pit and, you know, run over a tray of dirty pots to get the dishwasher to get the pots back quicker too. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's the whole chain, you know, you don't want to have any kind of weak link there.
And Mario, tell us about cooking in Terminal 5 at JFK Airport. I mean, how that must be completely turning head over heels what you grew up with in a traditional kitchen, or isn't it? Is it actually the same thing?
I mean, comparing where I am now to where I were most recently Del Posto, I have as many cooks as they have sous chefs. So, you know, to feed an equal amount of people. So it's a different beast in every sense of the word. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have 8 total guys on payroll to do 21 shifts a week. And it's not easy at times, you know, and throw in just being in an airport and all the logistical nightmares that go with that. You know, you've seen firsthand trying to deliver food to the airport. Forget about trying to create it. You know, but it's a challenge, and you need to go forward.
And you know, since institutionalized dining, like an airport or a stadium or a school or a hospital or an old person's home, is so important. You know, towards the future, what have you learned? Difference between working with an institution versus working at a restaurant? Like, how is the difference? Like OMT management. Who are those guys? Is it
OTG?
OTG. Is it easy to maneuver with them? Do you have the same freedoms, or are you dealing with a bureaucracy that you didn't deal with in other places?
First, the difference with just food and the clientele is that you need to have, me personally, you need to have a thick skin. Mm-hmm. Because you're no longer cooking for Mario Batali and the drones of Bataliites that are coming and they already love what they had and they haven't even walked in the door yet, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And here I'm dealing with, you know,
angry people who've been waiting in line for an hour.
They're at an airport, they don't want to be there. Yeah. They don't want to eat what I'm serving them. This isn't what they expected. You know, you need to have a thick skin and you need to kind of try and persevere if you're looking to really change, you know, change the game at an airport and serve quality. You're gonna come up with a good amount of fights, you know, day to day. You know, I didn't want this. Where are the meatballs? You said this is an Italian restaurant. I don't understand.
And you're cooking ossobuco from Heritage Hans. And they want meatballs.
And they're not getting it from time to time, you know. But then there's the clientele that absolutely adores it and is, you know, so happy that you're going the extra mile and you're putting in that effort.
Well, if you're anywhere near Upper West Side, Bar Balou's the place to go. And if you have to travel, certainly JetBlue is catapulted itself to the top of the list of airlines thanks to JFK Airport and their dining hall alone. What an honor to have you guys. Thank you so much. And I'm sure there are going to be so many people logging on to our archives and learning things about what you guys talked about. So thanks for coming out.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks for having us.
My mind, so many days of wasted time. You were so kind, then you changed your mind. Living on a railroad track, so many miles not looking back. You had my heart, then you left me flat.
Hi, welcome.